Today's shir has been dedicated by Sasha Clark, Le'iloi Nishmas William Kamita, on his yard site, along with his wife, Joanne. He has a beautiful family, encouraging their children to pursue their dreams. The schos of Torah learning from this shir should provide the neshama with a continuous aliyah. We're on Yud Aleph Mid Aleph, the top line, the third word on the line, where it says, Unkelis. Gemara yesterday related a couple of stories of some righteous higher-ups in the Roman Empire. We learned about Antoninus, who had a very close relationship with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And we learned about a Roman official, Ketiah Bar Shalom, for their righteous deeds. These people merited a portion in the world to come. Gemara today relates another story involving a uniquely righteous person from the Roman Empire. That is Uncalus Bar Clonimus. Gemara tells us a Gaier. There was a Roman named Uncalus, the son of Clonimus. This would appear to be the very famous convert from Rome, who wrote the extremely important translation of the Torah into Aramaic, that is pretty standard in most Chumashim. Although it's possible there were two different individuals named Uncalus, and that this was a different person. Anyway, the Gemara tells us that this Uncalus, son of Clonimus of Rome, converted to Judaism. And this person evidently had an uncanny ability to explain to people the beauty and the truth of Judaism, which would inspire them to convert. The Gemara relates, Shadar Kesar Gunda de Ramaya Basre. Caesar sent a troop of Roman soldiers after Uncalus to go and get him. However, Uncalus used his powers of persuasion in Mashchinu Bekroi and Igayar. He drew them in by teaching them some psukim from the Torah, taught them a little bit of the truth of the Torah. It made such an impression on them that a guy, they all converted too. Caesar tried again. Caesar sent another group of soldiers to get Uncalinus Amalahu. And this time he instructed the soldiers, do not discuss anything with this Uncalinus. And so they apprehended Uncalinus. However, as they were taking Uncalinus along with them, Amr Lahu, he said to them, I'll tell you a small little thing. Let me share one little thing with you. He said as follows, he went through like the hierarchy of the different officials, the people in power. So starting from the lowest level official, the Nifyora, he would carry a torch before the Fifyora, the next official up. And he in turn would carry the torch for Duchsa Lagmona, and the next one up is Agmona Lakoma. Finally, Agmona, which is almost the king himself, would hold the torch for Koma, for the king. That's, of course, how it's done, in order to properly recognize the rank and file. So Uncalinus said to these Roman soldiers, Kuma minakad nura mikmeinchi. Would the king ever hold the torch before commoners? Amrilay said to Uncalinus, lo, of course not. Amrilahu, Uncalinus then said to them, you should know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu Nakat Nura Kamei Yisrael. God himself carried a torch and led the way for his people, for his servants Yisrael. Where does it say this? Tichsiv, it says in the Torah that when the Bnei Yisrael are traveling through the Midbar, VeHashem Holech Lifnei Em Yomam, God would travel before them by day with a pillar of cloud, and by night God led the way with a pillar of fire, which demonstrates how much Hashem loves his people. He loves Bnei Yisrael. That is the people whom I have joined. It's made a deep impression upon them. And Igayakulu, this group of soldiers as well, all converted to Judaism. Caesar was getting really fed up at this point. He sent yet another group of soldiers after Uncalinus and Malu, and he told them, very clearly, lo tishto midi bade. Do not discuss anything with him. So they apprehended Uncalinus and kinakti levi azli. As they were taking him along with them, chazim mezuzah de mancha pischa. Uncalinus saw a mezuzah fixed to the doorway. Osiv yadi Allah. He put his hand on the mezuzah. And as he was doing this, v'yamalahu, he said to these Roman soldiers, my hi, what is this scroll here that's affixed to the doorpost? What is this? And so with this, he piqued their curiosity, and they couldn't help it. They asked him, Eimelonat, you tell us what this scroll attached to the doorpost is about. Amrilehu, so Uncalinus explained to them that whereas minhago shel olam, melech baser v'dam yoshev mibifnim v'avadim mishamer mosam mibachutz, the way of this world is that the mortal, the flesh and blood king, sits within his palace, and his servants guard the king from outside of the palace. However, v'yilu v'akadosh baruch hu, but by Hashem, it's just the opposite. That is, Avadav Mibifnim, his servants, the Jewish people, stay inside of their homes, Vehu Mishamra Mibachutz, and Hashem protects them from outside. Shenemar, as we see in the Pasuk in Tehillim Kufchaf Aleph, where it says, Hashem Yishmor Tseischa Uvayacha Me'atav Yad Olam, Hashem will protect when you go out, when you come back in, forever. That's what this mezuzah represents, that our God, our King of Kings, stands outside and protects us while we remain inside. And this message hit home with this group as well in Agayer. They all converted too. When this happened, Sulu Shadar Basra, the Caesar, stopped sending more soldiers. He gave up. He realized it was no use. Unclinus was such an effective orator. He was so sincere that Caesar realized anybody he would send would be held under the sway of Unclinus, and his message would cause him to convert. And so he left this and gave up. Gemara comes back to the relationship between Rebbe and Antoninus, the emperor of Rome. Gemara quotes the pasuk in which Rivka Imenu receives the prophetic message of the twins that she was carrying. Pasuk there says, "Vayomer Hashem lo shnei goyim mevitnech." Hashem said to Rivka Imenu, "There are two nations in your womb." And you're able to feel already how they're in conflict, and they represent like opposite kind of values. Of course, Rivka was carrying Yaakov, who would be forefather of Bnei Yisrael, and Esav, the forefather of Edom and Rome. Now, the classic understanding of this relationship is that it would be an inverse relationship, that if one nation would rise up, then the other would be down. The Gemara brings a drasha here. Amar Rav Yehuda Marav. Rav Yehuda said, in the name of Rav, Al Tikri Goyim. Don't read it Goyim, as it's traditionally pronounced. El Geyim. Since the actual spelling in the Torah, the letters are Gimel Yud Yud Mem. Therefore, it allows for a drasha that we could pronounce it as Geyim, proud ones. And it was this referring to Zu Antoninus V'Rabbi, two specific future descendants of each of these children that would be born to Rivka. Antoninus of Rome and Rebbe, of course, the Nasi of the Jewish people. And in their day, it would be an exceptional kind of a period where, you know, both nations enjoy great power and they have like a working positive relationship. And testimony to this is the great wealth that both of these leaders would enjoy. Shelo pasku mi'al shulchanam, lo chazeres, lo kishus, lo tzenon. They wouldn't lack, you know, any kind of produce. They never lacked the lettuce or cucumber or radish. All those could be found on their tables. Lo b'mosa cham, lo b'mosa gashamim. There was no lack of this, you know, variety of different types of produce, not in the summer or the winter. Even if for the average person it would be very difficult to attain such an array of produce. And the Gemara adds, the Amar Mar, Mar said, tzenon mechate chochel, radishes are very beneficial. They help break down the food, and chazeres mehapich machol, same with the lettuce, it turns over the food as it's digested. Kishus marchav meyayim, the cucumbers are beneficial, for they expand the intestines. What questions this last statement that cucumbers are healthy? V'atana deber bishmol, but I, Tana deber bishmol, said, lo menikr shman kishuin, why do cucumbers have the name kishuin? It says, mipnei shekoshin legufa shalodim kecharavas, because they are harsh on the body like swords. This appears to be saying that the cucumbers are not healthy. But the Gemara answers, Lokasha, it's not a contradiction. For Ha, but Rav Ravi, this last statement of Tanna Rabbi Shmuel is referring to a certain type of large cucumbers that could be harmful, apparently. Ha, bezutri. Whereas we said above that the cucumbers are very healthy, it's referring to a smaller variety of cucumbers. Coming back to the Mishnah now, which listed the different idolatrous festivals of Rome, the Mishnah mentioned the birthday of the emperor and the anniversary of the day the emperor died, the emperor's Yahrzeit. The Mishnah said these days would be observed as idolatrous festivals, and therefore the rabbinic prohibition against commerce leading up to and on these festivals would apply. Now that was Rabbi Meir's opinion. However, the Mishnah then brought that the Chachamim say that as far as the emperor's Yahrzeit, it would only be a problem if the ceremony included burning some of the emperor's possessions, which would be an indication that they're really, you know, designating this as a serious occasion, and presumably idolatrous sacrifices would be brought. But if the king's or the emperor's clothes were not burnt, then we do not assume that the ceremony would include idolatrous sacrifices, and therefore the rabbinic prohibition against commerce would not apply. So the Gemara observes, Mechlal, the Rabbi Meir Savar, Lo shna misa sheyesh basreifa, velo shna misa shein basreifa. Seems that in Rabbi Meir's opinion, regardless of whether the ceremony on the anniversary of the day the emperor died included burning some of his possessions, even if that did not happen, Rabbi Meir assumes, Regardless, we assume that this was an actual idolatrous festival in which they would bring idolatrous sacrifices. So the Gemara observes, Alma Sreifa Lav Chukahir. So we see that according to Rabbi Meir, the act of burning a deceased king's possessions is not necessarily understood to be an idolatrous ceremony. Whereas, Mechlal the Rabbanan Savri, in the Rabbanan's opinion, it seems, in their opinion, Sreifa Chukahi. This process of burning the king's possessions is an idolatrous rite that was performed, which appears to be the underlying reasoning of the Rabbanan. That is, why do the Rabbanan insist that we only consider it an idolatrous festival if they're burning the possessions? Oh, because it seems the Rabbanan are saying, burning the king's possessions is itself an idolatrous practice. And so surely if this was a day that they would be bringing idolatrous sacrifices, it would include this rite, the ritual of burning the king's possessions. The Gemara has a question on this, which is, V'hotanya, I was taught in a Braisa, Sarfin ala malachim. Braisa says, we do this. We go ahead and burn some of the deceased king's possessions to show honor to that king. And the Braisa says, V'lomi darke wa mori. This does not represent the violation of the prohibition not to follow in the ways of the Amorite. That is, you know, imitating the rituals of pagan nations. It's not a violation of that. We shall see the reason later. But the Gemara points out that V'i chukahi, 1 minute here. If the Rabbanan of our Mishnah are saying that this is actually an idolatrous practice, Hanan Hechi Sarfinan, how could we do this on the death of a Jewish king? Torah says, I shall not go in their statutes, referring to the statutes of idolatrous nations. The Gemara is asking, you know, setting aside the issue of following a custom of the pagan nations, if we have a ritual that is an idolatrous ritual, then certainly that should be prohibited under V'chukoseyem lo seylechu. The Gemara therefore says, Ella, rather, the Kuli Alma Sreifa Lav Chukahi. Gemara concludes that in all opinions, even according to the Rabbanan, this practice of burning the king's clothing after his death is not deemed an idolatrous practice. Ela Chashivusahi. Rather, the real point of this ritual is to show honor for the king, to show his importance. And V'hacha B'hacha Miflagi. And here's what Rabbi Meir and the Rabbanan are arguing about. Rabbi Meir Savar Lo Shna Misa Sheyesh Basreifa V'lo Shna Misa She'ein Basreifa. Rabbi Meir's opinion, whether or not they actually observe this particular ritual of burning the king's clothing, either way, if there's some kind of ceremony, they observe something on the anniversary of the death of the emperor, Pochila Lavodos Kochavim, we presume that that ceremony will include bringing idolatrous sacrifices. Whereas Rabbanan Savri, Rabbanan Hold, Misa Sheyesh Basreifa Chashiva Lehu Upal Chiba, if that anniversary includes burning the king's possessions, only then do we assume that there's going to be idol worship happening on that day. V'shem Basreifa Lo Chashiva V'lo Pal Chiba. But if the day of the emperor's Yartzeit does not include burning the emperor's clothing, and that is simply a sign that they're not taking the day so seriously. If they're not taking the day so seriously, there's no assumption that idolatrous sacrifices are brought. The Gemara discusses this further. Gufa, let's see the text itself that was quoted above. The Braisa said, Sarfin ala malachim. We will do this. We will burn possessions of the king to show honor to a Jewish king that died. Raisa said, "V'ein bo mishum darkei v'amori." Doing this is not a violation of losaseh kamaseim, that you shall not follow pagan customs, even if it's not an idolatrous custom, but if it's uniquely pagan custom, then the Torah prohibits it. That prohibition does not apply here. Why should Nemar? For actually, there's a source in the Torah for this practice. For it says in Yirmiyah, Hashem says to Tzidkiyo, B'shalom tamus uchemisrefos avosecha melachim. God assures the Yomelech that you will die a natural death, that will be followed by the ceremony of the burning, like the other kings who came before you. So the Navi itself refers to this rite of, you know, burning the king's clothing after his death in honor of that king. So being that there's a source in the Torah for doing this, so clearly it's not a uniquely pagan custom, and therefore there's no issue here of velosasek maseyim. The Raisa continues, Ukashem Shesarfin ala Malachim, just as we do this in honor of a Jewish king that died, Kach Sarfin ala Nasiim. We also follow this ritual upon the death of a Nasi, a spiritual and halachic leader of the Jewish people. From the death of a Nasi, we do this as well. Umahim Sarfin ala Malachim, what kind of possessions do they burn for Jewish kings that died? The Raisa says, Mitasan, Nuklei, Tashmishan, their beds, and different utensils, things they used. And the Brisa tells us, "Umaisa shemes Rabbi Gamliel Azakein." Upon the death of Rabbi Gamliel Azakein, who was Nasi, Saraf Alav Unkelin Sager Shivim Manetzori. Unkelis, the convert mentioned earlier, burned 70 manetzori, 70 Tyrian manas. So it seems he burned this huge amount of money. One Rabbi Gamliel Azakein upon his death. The Gemara asks on this, I thought we just said that the leader's personals were burned. You don't just go burn money. The Gemara answers, Eima b'shivim manetzori. What was meant was that they burned an amount of Rabbi Gamliel's possessions valued at 70 manetzori coins. The Gemara asks, Umidya chrina lo, but they wouldn't burn any other kind of things upon the death of a king or other leader. In Ayat Tanya it says, in Ebraisa, okrina l'malachim, we quote-unquote uproot animals like horses, also in honor of the king upon the king's death. As we'll see, it means that the animal's tendon and its leg is severed, which makes it permanently disabled. That is another way this ritual is performed, v'ein bo mishum darkei amori. And doing so is not a violation of following the ways of pagan nations. So the Gemara asks that now it seems to broaden the practice, even not to the king's personals. But the Gemara answers, Amar Papa, or Papa said, that no, it's specifically referring to Sus Shirachav Alav. It's saying the horse that the king himself rode on. So it is his personal item. We go and uproot that horse. We hamstring his horse in honor of the king. But the Gemara still questions a behemoth, Tahara Lo. But would they not even hamstring kosher animals? So these are animals, you know, obviously, you know, the king was not riding on. And yet, apparently, they would hamstring these two. V'vra Tanya, for it says in the Braisa, regarding this practice, that ikar sheyesh ba treifa usur. It would be prohibited to do the ikar, to hamstring the animal in a way that rendered the animal a treifa. Treifa means that the animal has, you know, one of the specific kind of injuries that puts it in a category where now, even if it has a proper ritual slaughter, it will not be kosher for consumption. So the rule is you cannot hamstring the animal in a way that renders it a treifa. V'sheim a treifa mutter. As long as you avoid rendering the animal a treifa, then it will be permitted to do this in honor of the king. The Rice explains further, V'yezehu ikor she'ein but treifa. How does one do the ikor? How does each hamstring cripple this animal without making it a treifa? Turning to Amid Beis, the answer is, Hamenasher parso se'a mina markuva ulamata. One accomplishes it by severing the tendons from the arkuva and below. So this is like the of the three sections, the three major bones of the animal's leg, the lowest one, between the lowest section, the lowest bone, and the next bone, there's a joint there, the arkuva, the hock, he has to sever the tendons, point there or below, and then it won't become a trefa. That's where he has to make sure to do the incision. So the Gemara's question is, if from this whole discussion, where we're talking about avoiding making the animal a trefa, clearly we're discussing a kosher animal. That's where the status of being treifa is relevant. And so evidently, you perform this ritual in honor of the king, even by kosher animals. The question then returns, I thought we only do this by the king's, you know, personal possessions, things he would, you know, use for himself. So how does that apply by kosher animals? And the Gemara answers, Tirgum Rapab. Rapab interpreted that it would be referring to, for example, Be'egla Moshechas Bekorum, the calf that pulls the king's wagon. So calf is a kosher animal. If it pulled the king's wagon, it would be considered the king's personal animal, and therefore would also be subject to this ritual of the ikor that is done to honor the king. Mishnah then mentioned a day of a personal idolatrous celebration. That was Yom Tiglacha Zikono, the day a pagan would shave his beard, ubluriso. Mishnah also added, and the lock of hair he grew in back. The Gemara seeks clarification of the reading of the Mishnah here. Ibailu, they ask, Teshi Kitani. How do we read this part of the Mishnah? Is the Mishnah saying, Yom Tiglachas Zikono Vehanochas Bluriso? Does it mean that on this day, the pagan would shave off his beard, and on that same day, leave his blurisa, leave the lock of hair growing in back? That is what's considered an idolatrous, you know, mini festival for this person, and therefore they would prohibit, you know, commerce with him on that day. Odilma Yom Tiglacha Zikono Vehavaras Blurisa. Or maybe the Mishnah is saying two separate things, that is, either shaving off the beard or removing that lock of hair growing in back, which was done once a year. Either of those events would, you know, constitute a personal idolatrous festival for this person, and therefore the Rabbanu would say that you can't do business with him on that day. Maybe that's what the Mishnah is saying. The Gemara says, Toshma, Ditanya, Tarvayu. Coming here, we have two brises that each go in a different direction on this. In one brise, it says, Yom tiglachas zikana v'hanochas blori. So it says the first way. It means, specifically, if he removes the beard and leaves that lock of hair growing in back, then that is significant enough to be considered an idolatrous personal festival. That's according to one brisa. But the other brisa says, Yom tiglachas zikana v'avaras blori. Actually, either event is considered a personal idolatrous festival. Either the day that he shaves off his beard and like leaves that lock of hair in back, or on the day that he, you know, annually, you know, removes that blariso in the back, that too is considered a personal idolatrous festival. So the answer to this question really depends on which of these brises you go with. When it relates another Roman idolatrous festival, Omer of Yehuda Marav, Oda Cheres Yesh Lohem Baromi, was another festival that was observed in Rome. This one was observed only once in 70 years and was specifically targeted at the Jewish people to celebrate the continued subjugation of the Jewish people to Rome. And that is, Achas L'Shivim Shana Mevi'in Adam Shalem, once every 70 years, it would bring this nice, big, healthy person, would be representative of the nation of Esav, of Edom, Markivin Osol Adam Chiger. And this strong, healthy person would ride on top of a crippled person who would represent the nation of Yaakov, Bnei Yisrael, Umalbishin Osol Bigdei Adam Harisham. The one on top would be dressed in the special clothing of Adam Harisham. And this had, of course, symbolic significance for Esav wore these very, you know, fine garments when he would go and hunt, and Yaakov wore this when he pretended that he was Esav to receive the brachos from Yitzchak. On his head they would place the karkeflo, the skin flayed from the head of Rabbi Yishmael. For we know Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, the Kohen Gadol, was brutally murdered under the Romans, and the daughter was transfixed by his beauty, and so they had his face, you know, flayed off of him and preserved. So on this barbaric festival, they would place that skin of Rabbi Yishmael on the head of this strong, healthy Roman riding on top of the crippled person representing Yaakov. And on his neck they would hang a large weight, a very precious stone, and they would cover the streets with another precious stone, and they would announce before him, Sach Kiri Plaster, who proudly declared that, look, the calculation of the ruler of these people, of Yaakov Avinu, who predicted the downfall of our people, is wrong, didn't come to pass. Chua de Marana Zaifana, the brother of our forefather, Esav, his brother Yaakov, is a Zaifana, is a cheat and a crook, you know, referring to how Yaakov managed to get the brachas from Yitzchak instead of Esav. And they would announce, the Chamecha, may whoever gets to see this day, we'll see it today, but we'll likely not see it again in his lifetime because this only happened once every 70 years. And they continued their tirade, Mayahani l'ramam ramuse. How did the craftiness and the trickery of Yaakov, you know, help him? Didn't do anything for him. L'zayfonam, l'zayfonuse. How did his cheating help him? You see that the Jewish people's descendants are still dominated by us. Misaymin bahachi, and they would conclude, Vayledein kad yakum dein. Woe to this when this one should arise. So should Yaakov ever arise, and woe to this, woe to the nation of Esav, of Rome. The Gemara remarks, Amar of Ashi, Vashi said, Echshilin piyam l'rishayim. These wicked ones stumbled with their own mouths. For iyam ruzayfana chua de marana. If they were careful to express this with the words, the brother of our master, our forefather Esav, is Zaifana, he is a cheat. Well, then Kedekarmi, then they would have clearly expressed what they meant to say. Hashta the Amri, the Marana, Zaifana. Since that's not the sequence they used, rather they started with the Chua de Marana. Then next to the Marana, next to their reference to Esav, they said the word Zaifana, he's a cheat. Their words actually imply, almost seem to be saying, Marana Gufei Zaifanahu. Marana himself, you know, our forefather Esav, he was the crook. So Ravashi points out they didn't, you know, really properly express what they were trying to say. The Gemara wonders, Vitana Didan Maitan Maloka Chashivla. Indeed, why didn't the Tan of our mission include this additional Roman festival? The Gemara answers, Lahai de'isa b'choshasa v'shasa k'chashiv, de'lesa b'choshasa v'shasa lo k'chashiv. The answer is, our Mishnah is only listing those Roman pagan festivals that were observed each and every year, whereas this one was observed only once in 70 years. The Gemara now lists, Sahani d'Ramai, the list in the Mishnah listed the Roman pagan festivals, the Parsoi Mai. What about the Persian pagan festivals? The Gemara lists, those were Mutarde, Vituriske, Muranke, and Murarain. And the Gemara lists, Sani the Parser, the Ramai, we have the Persian and Roman ones, the Bavloimai. What about the Babylonian ones? The Gemara lists, Mwaranke, Veknise, Vechanune, Veeser Ba'adar. Those are the Babylonian pagan festivals. Gemara says further, Amar Rav Chanan bar Rav Chista, Amar Rav Yamri La, or some say it was Amar Rav Chanan bar Rava, Amar Rav, tells us that Chamisha Bate Avodas Kochavim Kavuin Hain. There are these five houses of idol worship that are Kavuin. They're fixed, they are in operation throughout the year. Elohein, they are Beis Baal beBavel, Beis Nevo beChursi, Terasa sheBeMapag, Srifa sheBeAshkelon, and Nishra sheBaravya. Those five idolatrous temples in those five locations. Ki Aser Avdim and Ravdimi came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, Osifo Alei and Yorit sheBein Bechi Nidbacha sheBeAko. He added another two. There is the idolatrous fair in Ein Bechi and the Nidbacha in Akko. Okay, the Amri Nisbara sheBeAko, or some say it was called Nis. Bara in Akko, or Ravdimi Minarda, Masli Ipcha, Ravdimi Minarda taught it in the reverse that it's a Yarit Shabbat, this idolatrous fair is in Akko, and Nidbacha Shabbat in Bechi. And the Gemara clarifies, Amrle Rav Chanan bar Rav Chista, Rav Chista, Mai Kavuanein. What is meant here when we said that they are fixed places of idol worship? Amrle, Rav Chista answered, Hachi Amr Avua Dimach, your mother's father said, Kivuin Hain Liolam Tidira Kula Shasa. They're fixed in the sense that they're in use throughout the year. Palchilahu, where they worship their idols there all year round. And the practical consequence of this is that a Jew would not be able to conduct business with them at any time, since they're bringing idolatrous sacrifices every day of the year. And so, by conducting business with them, as we explained by our Mishnah, you know, that could be a problem in terms of facilitating the idolatrous sacrifice or causing the pagan to go and thank his idol. Gemara continues, Omer Shmuel Shmuel said, Magola ino asar leyom edam bilvat. Here in the diaspora, you're in Bavel, outside of Eretz Yisrael, only the idolatrous festival day itself would carry the prohibition against commerce with idolaters. The Gemara asks, V'yom Edom Nami Miyasir? But is there even a prohibition on the idolatrous festival itself? But I, Rav Yehuda, Shara Leiler of Bruna, Lizvuni Chamra. But Rav Yehuda permitted Rav Bruna to sell wine to idolaters, or Rav Gidol, Lizvuni Chitin, and Rav Gidol to sell a wheat to these idolaters, Bechag Sedetaye, on the festival called Detaye, the festival of the merchants. This was a festival of the pagans. So how are these Amoraim permitted to go and sell things, and do commerce with them, on the festival itself of Chag Sedetaye? The Gemara answers, Shiny Chag Sedetaye de lo kaviyah. This Chag Sedetaye, this particular festival, wasn't an issue as far as our halacha, because it wasn't such a fixed holiday, they weren't so into it. Some years they wouldn't do it all together, so since it wasn't such a serious pagan holiday, therefore the rabbinic prohibition did not apply.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD1. That's 855-275-7231.